Welcome to Worker Movement, a podcast dedicated to the working class, a podcast dedicated to raising class consciousness. This podcast is for you, for us, for the worker.
On today's episode, we'll talk about game theory inherent to the recent protesting around the George Floyd murder. Game theory is the general study of exploiting rules to either maximize or minimize a potential outcome.
So the first part will be game theory as seen through the eyes of the protesters. And what does that mean, and how do they maximize sort of their outcomes? And if we think about it as the reason why everybody joined the streets and why the protest broke out was that we saw a police officer murder multiple police officers. And watch someone be murdered, basically, and were complicit. And the protest hits the streets because this violence is daily. You know, there's a catalyst that comes off, which is a murder, but there are other problems that happen every day, right? There's injustices that happen, there's shakedowns, there's, you know, turning their backs to other crimes. There's lots of things that happen daily. So the protesters find that the catalyst can come out and collectively begin to fight. And the question is, with game theory, what are they trying to gain? How do they maximize their outcome? And so if you think about an individual, they don't really have a voice or power in everyday transactions with the police officers or even with the city. And there's this idea that using electoralism, they can get that voice through elections or some other means by participating. But what they've seen and what we've all seen is that in that context, the individual loses. And so collectively, they come together and they fight. And so one of the outcomes is they can show and maximize their outcome of basically saying the police are corrupt and need to be fixed. And they join together and they fight with one voice. And with that, they can, you know, begin to talk amongst each other and begin to talk amongst the streets and show other owners and people that are around them and basically formulate what would not have been able to be formulated before in a giant group and have almost like a list of demands, right? And the news comes. And from the eyes of the protester, this is great because now they can come together and actually all have their grievances.
It's a more efficient utilization of resources. So in talking about a single individual, let's just say there's some generic task like painting a house. Painting a house requires, let's say, 1,000 brushstrokes. You get one individual, they go up and they paint one brushstroke, then they come back and do it again. Over time, it takes forever. The message is kind of lost. You see that house gradually painted over time. In the context of a protest, you get 1,000 people together. They do one stroke, house is done instantly. So it's a much harder transition between the absence of protesting and protesting. It's not a gradual transition that occurs. It's a hard cutoff of this was happening or was not happening, and now it is happening. And that's pretty much unmistakable from an outside observer, which is the intent of attempting to make a point as a protester, as an individual. But as a collective group, it also serves a purpose and it utilizes resources better.
And that's like, if you're coming into this without understanding game theory and understanding individualism, it's the idea that together we can win and apart we lose. And again, we talk about this and we talked about last time in game theory that we're trying to maximize the best potential what we have. And so the other thing that this one stroke does and this basically this power that comes to the voice, the gradual change, like you're saying in the house, is there's not multiple coats that go on. You're not priming it. You're not going through and you're going to and scrape it down and try to change it. You are actually asking for an immediate change to the system because you have the power to do that. And that's where the maximization comes, is not only do you have a collective voice and you show the power, but you also have the momentum to carry through a step change, a massive step change. And we see that already in sort of the news that's going around with Minneapolis. We saw that their attorney general in Minnesota was appointed to the special prosecution. We're seeing that the Minnesota Department of or Police Department has sort of been pulled to the side and not really engaging anything. And we're seeing the governor taking this seriously, which means that it's working. And through this massive protests and getting out on the streets, we're actually seeing that the game theory in this position works, because in the long haul, carrying on protests for months and weeks and years, I guess it's weeks, months and years, pulls everybody down and it degrades your energy over time. But having a week of protests and strong outrage, disrupting the flow of capital. So we're talking about just, you know, worker consciousness, or messing with the flow of capital in the streets of Minnesota, Minneapolis, means that you are now showing them what the true power is, which is spending.
Yeah, and if you were to think about it, if this general effort were to be dispersed over some longer period of time, I don't think people would care. And we've clearly seen that people have cared. The largest ever National Guard force got recalled to Minnesota, effectively larger than anything that was called up for the Iraq or Afghanistan garbage. I think this is the largest recall since World War II, to put some of this into context as to how many people were protesting and what the state response was to maintain this concept of order or safety, depending on kind of what your point of view is with respect to the specific Minneapolis.
Yeah, we'll cover that, the safety portion, through the eyes of protesters. So they're on the streets protesting because something isn't quite right with the idea of safety, because the idea of safety for the community that's protesting is the safety of walking down the street and not being murdered for an alleged crime, for not being stereotyped, right? For not being, you know, constantly abused and mishandled, for not being abused from capital, for capitalists, from not, for no reason.
Yeah, for an alleged very benign crime, which was allegedly counterfeiting a $20 bill, which is probably a direct result of capitalism creating a situation in which an individual could not get the food they needed during a pandemic.
And that leads us into the next part, which is looking through game theory in the eyes of the rioters. And we'll first focus on the ones that are aligned, the rioters that are aligned to the ideology of the protest. And if we look through the eyes of, again, the protesters, it's this anti-police abuse, and it turned into basically an anti-capitalist, you know, struggle at that point in time. The rioters that began to loot the Target, allegedly the Target wouldn't sell them milk and things to help out with the pepper spray and the tear gas that the police were using against them. So it turned into sort of an anger that the establishment these people have to shop with every day to get their groceries, the same establishment that won't hire them but demand that they come shop there, wouldn't support them. And from that point of view, from the game theory point of view, how do you maximize sort of the context or the destruction at one point in time? You hit all the establishments that have been abusive to you. And you try to take down that power cycle, the power itself that is what's holding you back, that's funding the police, that's funding private property protections, that's charging you excessive rents, sorry, that's not employing you, and that's...
Because nobody's right. Charged excessive wages.
That's right.
It's not a thing.
Sorry about that. And basically, low wages, right? Holding you down in your area by promising you some subpar wage that you can't even afford to use to rent, but the way that the neoliberals set up the society and the system, you have to have a job to sustain your life. And so you're forced into basically indentured servitude. And that leads to basically untapped capitalist hatred. And you see that through that ideology there. They're not really, there's some people saying it, but most of the protesters are not saying they're anti-capitalist. But the rioters that are targeting hitting the for sale buildings or the capitalist buildings are doing it out of anger for that part of society.
So if we look at the Target incident as a completely hypothetical example where suppose I'm an individual and I just got tear gas in my eye and it really, really hurts, and I go to a place to buy something like milk, which will neutralize it to some degree, and just hypothetically they don't sell it to me. Whether this actually occurred or not, I have no idea. It's not really relevant. But so my eyes hurt. I want to buy milk. I want to pour it in my eyes so it hurts less, and I am not given the capability or the opportunity to exchange my money for milk to help me. in that scenario, this hypothetical individual then made the decision to steal the milk because it posed some direct, you know, injury to them by not having it. And then hypothetically, this kind of opened the door to, well, if I can steal milk, I can steal a TV, I can steal whatever. So from a certain corporate point of view, was charging somebody for milk the correct theory in the context of game theory? Probably not, given that Target has closed down pretty much every store in Minneapolis and a bunch of stores elsewhere. And for whatever reason, protesters in other states are explicitly going after Targets as kind of a copycat thing, I guess. So all these economic concepts are rooted in game theory with regard to, if I do X, what can I expect my outcome to be? So some individual, some hypothetical individual at Target, because again, we don't know if this actually happened, made a decision not to sell milk, which is $3, $4, $5, depending on how big of a whatever container they were buying, whether the cow had to walk uphill or look at the sun, if it was organic or not. And this kind of benign decision over some very little monetary value caused an entire Target store to get looted, caused damage to Target, the corporate being, because a number of other stores were also closed subsequently, and kind of kicked off the realization that as a protesting entity, nobody was going to stop looting.
There is fundamentally too many people for the police to stop, because the only reason the police have power, and we won't go into this too much, is that you believe that they have the power to stop you. And as soon as they lose that control and that grip, they no longer can ask you to stop what you're doing, because they have to force you to do it. And if they're outnumbered 100 to 1, there's no way that one individual on the police side is going to be able to stop 100 people on the other side, which is why you see that giant activation of the National Guard, of the military police, and the president attempting to use a law that was invoked in 1807 in order to try to get the government to allow him access to troops to stop the rioting and the protesting across the entire country.
So if you're, let's say, a looter or a rioter and your sole interest is to cause harm, using the protests as cover to cause harm is sort of a viable option, where it's kind of a strategic, I want to do X, but I can blame it on Y. And so with some of the entities that were burned, like post offices and libraries, there's not really a coherent ideology associated with those structures other than sort of anti-government. So the distinction between burning a Wells Fargo, for example, and burning a library or a post office, the culmination of those three buildings do not kind of incur a consistent ideology. So, you know, a conclusion can be made that there were perhaps different segments of rioters causing damage associated with their specified ideology. And then we kind of thirdly have the burning of the Third Precinct building, which on its surface, and we don't really know who actually burned it, but that is more kind of a intuitive direct correlation between, okay, the cops that murdered this individual worked at that precinct, so if we burn that precinct, that sort of sends a message that we're not okay with this. So you kind of have those three different burning of building kind of nodes, and you can look at this and just say it's all random, or perhaps you can look at it and say there's three different entities that are sort of playing the game to optimize whatever their intended outcome is.
Yeah, because during this chaos right now, all eyes are turned to the peaceful protesters to call them violent. So if you are a anti-government, right-wing individual, this is a perfect time for you to go out and burn associated buildings and make it appear that the rioters just pissed off at everything. Everything's going to burn. But it doesn't make any sense from a game theory point of view for the people that are mad at the Capitol, mad at the police station or the police, to burn institutions that are good to them, like the mail or the post office and the library. It also, even small businesses, yes, it doesn't make any sense to burn
or
down
even
the
small
local
businesses
barbecue
that they own.
Place or the bar you sit at or the liquor store. I mean, maybe loot it, but not burn it to the ground, especially when there's houses nearby. It does make sense in that same context for rioters, and I'm not condoning any violence, to go out and destroy the police car because that's where the anger is. But it doesn't make sense for them to go out and destroy other public or private, I'm sorry, other private property, other people's cars or other people's houses, because that's not the ideology they're fighting against. They're not fighting their own neighborhoods. And so there has to be a distinction between when someone says that they're fighting and destroying their own community, and you say, well, their community is the homes, the houses, and the people. The community is not the businesses. Whereas the individuals that are out burning the governments are doing it because they are trying to maximize the potential for damage on their end with minimizing their potential to get caught. And then you're seeing now the need to distinguish between the two, because a lot of chaos will come in if you start charging individuals who had nothing to do with those crimes, especially if there's out-of-state actors or out-of-state areas or whatever you want to call them, or people from other districts coming in to basically take advantage through game theory to maximize their outcome. And again, if you think about purely from the risk management point of view, these individuals who would never have hit these buildings during peaceful times now had the opportunity to. So something they've been planning for years can now take place.
Yeah, and there's very little risk. And it also creates this kind of puzzling narrative that also leads to ambiguity. So you have a bunch of protesters and there's, you know, tens of thousands and buildings are being burned. So nebulously, the protesters get blamed. And then there's this attempt to say, oh, well, they're bad actors. They're out of state. There's just a lot of muffled messaging with not a lot of hard information about who's actually doing anything. And so that very concept also creates confusion, yep, which kind of furthers the message if your goal is to spread chaos. So by creating chaos, you sort of create additional chaos in having people trying to identify who's causing the original chaos.
The state itself is blind to what's going on in the streets because they're not part of that movement. Just like the protesters are blind to what the state's planning on doing, the state is blind to what the protesters are planning on doing. And the arsonists and the rioters. And so you have this narrative in which everybody's viewing the whole world through very, very small sort of holes, right? Very, like, I don't know, with blinders on, because they can only see their piece of the puzzle. And so you're hearing a lot of conflicting things in the news and other places because all the information is not shared amongst every group. And for good reason, because each group is independent of one another and every group is acting in their own best interest, which is, again, that game theory, you know, point of view.
Yeah, so the protesters are seeking to achieve whatever their desired outcome is. The rioters, the looters, the arsonists are attempting to achieve their outcome. The state legal apparatus is attempting to achieve their outcome. And all these outcomes are in some manner kind of diametrically opposed to each other. And I mean, yes, there's overlapping, and that's kind of where the advantages, the market efficiencies, if you will, kind of come into play, where the rioters and protesters are sort of implicitly working together, and they're not consenting and working together, but their kind of objectives overlap. And there's a mutual benefit that isn't overtly intended. And then you have the, you know, from the law enforcement angle, you have, there's a clear intent to bring in the National Guard, bring in the State Patrol, to prevent arson from happening, which sort of diametrically opposes the arsonists. And then at the same time, there's an intent to sort of sideline the Minneapolis Police Department because that could create angst with the protesters. And so there's all these competing objectives that are happening simultaneously. The state law enforcement apparatus then collectively has this desire to prevent the burning of everything. And they simultaneously have a scarcity of resources in a manner that's similar to the protesters. So the first couple nights of the rioting and the fires, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, the police, the state patrol, the National Guard had limited resources. I believe Governor Wall said something along the lines of, there's the more around. Of us than there are of them.
Yep.
There are more of them than there are of us with regard to how many, you know, how many law enforcement entities there were versus the number of protesters. And I mean, that's a ramification of the protesters taking advantage of this game theory and saying, well, if we all show up right now, there's more of us than there is.
And in the context of most society, that's the way it is, right? You don't need, you know, 100,000 police for 100,000 civilians because there's not the chaos. And so from the state's point of view, to try to bring resources up and to gather, you know, the intelligence they need and to formulate a plan is not instantaneous, because they did not do a systems or a scenario planning for a riot based on the murder of a person from police hands and the reaction is going to happen from the group. Now, they may have plans in place. What happens if there's a natural disaster here or there is rioting? But this culmination was large and there was nothing they could have done to plan this. I mean, we're talking about taking an entire police force and sidelining them and then bringing in sheriffs from counties away, which now limits the amount of resources in other areas. And it leads to the inability for people to rest and you get fatigued. Now, we are not on the side of the state, nor are we on the side of the police in this podcast. But what we're getting at is from their point of view, the first few nights of chaos, it was their planning. And then they have to come in days 4 and 5 now, and you've seen that, and the rhetoric has changed, to bring that chaos back in. Because they are trying to prevent prior property destruction, not the pain and suffering of human beings that are mad and angry, but they're trying to prevent the capitalist class from getting mad at them for letting things burn. And that's,
and there's also some legitimate concern too about actual public safety, where you have gas stations are on fire next to urgent care centers, next to apartments, next to places where pregnant women are kind of preparing to give birth. So there's some like legitimate health concerns that the law enforcement entities, I think, correctly sort of prioritized as being important to safeguard. And this kind of goes back as well to the protesters' intent of, if they're interested in being peaceful and then the National Guard, law enforcement imposes a curfew, it's sort of simultaneously in their best interest to obey the curfew because it allows the bad actors to be targeted, which could change the narrative. But it's also not in their best interest to obey the curfew, because then this kind of concept of civil disobedience and raising the kind of public relations specter of, we're going to paint this house really
right,
fucking
and,
quick.
And to be fair to the protesters, the amount of action that took place when the agitators kicked in was beneficial to them. And they're mutually beneficial on both ends, because the amount of protesters gave cover to the agitators gave cover to the protesters. And it also gave, and that's the unintended consequence, the cover to the other side that wants to take advantage of the chaos. So now the state has to simultaneously fight both entities of chaos, which they're not equipped to do. And so you've seen things like, and to go back to that discussion about protecting certain buildings, right? The gas station on fire is insane. Who would want to burn down a gas station unless you're trying to make a point of something? And so the question then is, how does the fire department handle this? How do you keep the people whose job it is to put out fires safe at a time when everything's on fire and it's spreading towards hospitals and other, you know, private properties that are like human, like houses? Like public houses. And that's where the state has to balance, to their eyes, the balance between cracking down and going to a full-out war, basically, with the protesters, and maintaining some level of peace in order to be able to move through the streets and put out fires as they come up. Because a full-scale lockdown would mean that the police would have to advocate for more violence. The state would have to allow that, and then they'd have to basically fight on multiple fronts continuously while burning up all the resources. And that's why for the first few nights of this the protesting and the nighttime rioting, the police were basically at a standstill and pulled back, because there was nothing they could do if they wanted to make sure this didn't do a full-fledged chaos that would have resulted in much more damage and potentially loss of life.
Yeah, so the state entities made a conscious decision to cede certain areas, I think mainly the police station of the third precinct, while allocating resources to defend other territory. We don't really exactly know what territory they were defending, but I mean, just thinking about it from a, they're probably defending the Capitol, there's probably power station, there's bridges, there's federal buildings. You know, take your pick at some wide collection of potential targets. They're very clearly interested in protecting those, given they have finite resources. And if that means that a brick building burns down, that's not a terrible sort of trade-off from an economic game theory perspective for them. So it's very likely that there was an intentional decision by the state kind of actors to. I think it was Wednesday where the. Wednesday or Tuesday where the third precinct burned. I mean, it's a very direct building. You let it burn. Everybody occupies that single space. It's one building. It doesn't spread. The chaos doesn't multiply.
Institutions are important, and we can argue back and forth about capitalism. The idea that we have the material conditions state that, you know, we have to engage in capitalism means that things like maintaining a grocery store chains to provide food for the area is important. Things like gas stations are important. The hospitals, maintaining the histories in museums and in libraries, maintaining fire departments and other areas. Right, there's a whole list of things you have to maintain. News and other media has to be maintained. Light rail and other type of transportations have to make sure the city can keep going. But at the same time, that has to be balanced with the needs of the people that are living there, which is not always aligned. The needs of the people there are safety and security, but not in the way that are currently being, you know, portrayed. You know, the burning of the third precinct was symbolic because the individuals burning that do not find the safety in that building standing anymore, which is actually a very interesting question about whether or not it was designed to wedge the community apart, whether or not the burning of the third, made it sort of basically conflicting between those that viewed the third precinct to be a symbol of hate and those that saw the third precinct to be a symbol of security and safety.
Yeah, and I think the burning of the precinct, I think most people in Minneapolis are probably of the like mind that the Minneapolis Police Department is not necessarily a force for consistent good. And I think a lot of people would be willing to take their chances with the absence of police. And you've kind of seen that in recent days, people that own properties along Lake Street have been defending their own stores. There's been absolutely no violence as part of this. Zero fatalities, basically zero hospitalizations. I can't speak to the number of hospitalizations authoritatively, but to my knowledge, nobody has been seriously injured or maimed. There have been no fatalities. So in the absence of a occupying force that is the Minneapolis Police Department, the local community has not been negatively impacted, which probably leads to a position that
you're safer without the police them. And this is, thing. I think, the point of the protests, which is that the current structures and current constructs of policing are not in the best interest of the civilians that are there, the citizens, that they're too often the victims of the police and not necessarily, you know, benefiting from them. And it's a very interesting tell when you see that the community bands together and protects itself instead of relying on the group of people that they were told were there to protect them.
Yeah, when any community starts destroying and then replacing institutions that previously had authority, that's
step changes.
In essence, change
looking for how does the institution benefit us And it goes back to game theory. What's the benefit? What am I going to get out of this? And is it worth something I want to deal with? And in the end, if it's something you shouldn't deal with, if it's economically against you, if it's politically against you, if it's physically against you, or the violence is too much, if they're protecting the needs of the private companies and not the needs of the people, right? Because again, this is about fraud. So a gentleman was murdered. George was murdered because of alleged fraud against a for-profit institution. And so you saw the police coming to protect this institution and protect the exchange of capital in order to make sure that the institution stands, that this for-profit stands.
For future episodes and to learn more about the worker movement, join us at workermovement.com.